So this week is Parshat Tzav. Parshat Tzav goes into all kinds of details, korbanot, how they're done, where they're brought, how they're brought. So we are deep in Sefer Vayikra. So I look back at past years, there's like a little verse here and there, one talking about chametz and one talking about matzah, and you know that's how we generally get out of all the korbanot, is we somehow bring it back into the Pesach theme. So we're going to do that again now, but through a different pasuk. So let's take a look. Paragraph pasuk of Aleph, ukli cheres asher tevushalbo yishaver, ve'im bikli nechoshet bushala umarok v'shutaf b'mayim. So these are laws which probably we're more familiar with, Pesach laws, Kashrut laws, but over here it's being said in the middle of the discussion of the korbanot. So as I said, that's something which we need to understand what really the context is and what the teaching is. So a korban, you know, let's go backwards a second. On Pesach, one of the things we say about the korban Pesach is b'chol alelot, right? We eat it, whether it's cooked or whether it's prepared different ways or roasted. And now tonight it's only roasted. Do we say that, or it's only in the Mishnah we say that, right? It's one of the four questions, but only in the Mishnah. Right, baser tzli shlok u'shal halayla zeh kulo tzli. To this night we only eat tzli. Of course, today without the korban Pesach, without the Beit Hamikdash, most customs or many customs are not to eat tzli. So it's specifically that we don't say that. But the various korbanot, and this is really the point. I don't know if most of you realize this. The various korbanot could, once they're shechted, they could be prepared in different ways. So if you take a look at this pasuk again, it's talking about if you cook the korban. Now, let me just focus a little bit more on context. The context of this particular pasuk is the korban chatat. So let's go backwards so we can understand a little bit more about what it is we're up to and what it is we're talking about. Different korbanot are consumed by different people, or sometimes not consumed at all. Last week we discussed the korban olah, so the korban olah is not eaten by anybody. It is completely consumed, which is one of the suggestions on why it's called olah. A korban shlamim, which is really like a Thanksgiving offering. So a korban shlamim is eaten by the people who bring it. They invite guests. They make a whole Thanksgiving party. And the kohanim get their part of it. So shlamim is good for everybody. It's good for the kohanim. It's good for everybody involved. The korban chatat, which is a sin offering. And again, to focus, the sin offering is a sin offering which is done when a person sins b'shogeg. So the sin offering is not eaten at all by the person who brings it, but rather the kohanim are the ones who partake of it. So this particular pasuk is talking about, the kohen has the korban chatat, and then he prepares it. So it says again, ukli cheres asher tuvu shalbo, if you prepared it in a kli cheres, if you prepared it in something which is earthenware, yishaver, then it must be broken afterwards, which we don't know yet why that is. On the other hand, if it was prepared in some kind of a metal utensil, so then it's just going to be washed off and cleaned off, and then it can be used again. So it comes down that the earthenware utensils are chad pami, right, used only once, and the other utensils are able to be cleaned. Rashi here writes, yishaver, it's broken, Lefisha habli'a shenivla'atpo na'asen notar. V'wadin l'kol hakadoshim. So Rashi is telling us, we'll say over the Rashi backwards, this is not just a law by chatat, it's a law by all korbanot. But all korbanot, when you prepared something in an earthenware vessel, there's a problem. The problem is that the vessel absorbs, but it's a one-way street over here. It absorbs the taste, but it doesn't expel the taste. And once, because it only absorbs, it doesn't expel it, the problem of Hirashi tells us is one of notar. A korban has a time clock on it as far as how long it could be eaten. And there are different laws by different korbanot and how long they can be consumed afterwards. So over here, what's going to be the problem? The korban can only be eaten for 1 day, 2 days, whatever the case may be. And over here, because the taste went into the utensil, it's still going to be in the utensil the next day or the day afterwards, and you're going to use it again, so therefore you'll be guilty of enjoying from a korban after the time came that you can no longer be eaten. That's what Rashi tells us. In source 3 of Chaim Paltiel, one of the Balei HaTosfot writes, "Ukli cheretz shetufu shabo yishaver v'im tomer lama yishaver v'lo noten tam lufgam v'hu mutar." So we just now have entered deep into the world of Yeridea. So there's a couple things we need to know. One is that on a halachic level, once 24 hours has gone by, we presume that any residual taste which is there is going to give a negative taste and not a positive taste. No tintam lufgam. So a negative taste, he's saying, that should not make a difference. V'yesh lomer gabe kodshim k'tiv l'mashcha k'derech shamalachim ochlim b'lo natiyatam lufgam. He's saying this is part of the honor of kodshim. The kodshim need to be eaten. It's as if, you know, you're eating, the kings will only eat something which is perfect, and kodshim need to be treated with a great respect as well. Rabbeinu Bachaye in source number 4 points out from the Gemara in Yom of Darshu Razal, Shahoyu acharesim nivla'im bikarka azara, she'im lo kein haita azara kulo mitmale charesim, v'yaz miyudchet nisim shenasu b'mikdash. So he says, is that what, he says, the Gemara tells us that this charis would somehow, comes from the ground, would be absorbed by the ground, and somehow be swallowed up by the ground. And this is one of the miracles that took place. He goes, otherwise, if you just think about it, you would have piles and piles and piles of broken cheres. I mean, that's interesting in terms of the various archaeological finds that they've made in various places around, in terms of cheres, which has been found. But you hopefully realize what the issue with cheres is because that it was deemed to be chad pa'ami. You can use it once, and afterwards there's a problem of notar, so it couldn't be used again. So there's a beautiful, although admittedly, even by him, homiletic interpretation of this by the Kli Yakar. Kli Yakar, for those of us who don't remember, he was the chief rabbi in Prague. Before that, he was a well-known preacher, going around from place to place, giving drashot. And apparently he was very, very good at it, and at one point he got extremely ill. He actually added a name to his name. And the Kli Yakar then made, when he was on his deathbed, he made a vow. He didn't die, by the way. I don't want to ruin the story for you, but he didn't die. When he was on his he's dead by now, but when he was on his deathbed and in a really extremely serious situation, he made a vow to God that, oh, fine, I'll publish my drashot so other people could, because this way he was able to use them when he would go from place to place. He would be able to use the same drashot time and time again. And if he publishes them, then anybody would have access to them. So he said, I will publish my drashot if I get better. And he got better and he published his drashot. He was the replacement of the Maharal from Prague in Prague. He was the rabbi right afterwards. And as far as I can tell, as far as the math goes, he actually replaced him during his lifetime when the Maharal got quite old, because he became the chief rabbi of Prague in 1605 and the Maharal died in 1609. So apparently he was the second, and he was, what do they call this, the younger rabbi, and then he became the rabbi emeritus, associate rabbi, became the, and the Maharal became the rabbi emeritus. And he was, as I said, he was there for a number of years. He's a wonderful, wonderful commentary, but he'll do this. He'll do this more than other commentaries. He'll go off into really homiletics and say things over in spiritual messages, symbolic messages, and he'll tell us very clearly what he's doing in a moment. Notar is when you would eat a korban after the time. So therefore the classic, after time. Right. So slow down. Classic notar is that this is a korban, just say, for example, that could be eaten until X amount of time. 2 hours later, you eat that korban, that's notar. Korban has a time limit on it. Over here, the problem is that the kli cheres absorbed the taste. So once it absorbed the taste, so now there's notar in the walls of the kli. That's the situation after the time. Exactly. And that's why I'm saying that once you use the kli cheres to prepare this, it has to be destroyed because it absorbs it and never expels it. Source 5, Kli Yakar. Ukli cheres asher tufushabu yishaver pirish rashi udin lakol hakodshim. This is a law by all kodshim, because by all kodshim there's going to be a time limit when you can have it. Umikom makom, and now he makes a really good observation. Umikom makom hadavr tzarech bir loma katva hatora din zeh dafka gabe chatata bala kapara. He goes, this law could have been written by any korban, actually except for the korban Pesach, because that's not cooked, it's roasted. But Correct, because it's not cooked, But what he's saying over here is, he's asking, why is it written specifically in the context of the sin offering and not written by any other offering where it could have been written? Ukfi ha-pshat, nuchalomer lefisha Torah ha'ida al kli cheresh enu yotze midei dofav la'olam. Then when it comes to kli cheresh, we're told that it absorbs and never expels. Usal kadai techamina, I would have thought dafka b'kodshim kalim nechel l'shnei yamim v'layla echad shamachal mit'akev b'kater zman rav alkeinu bolei kol kach harbe ad she'enu yotze midei dofav la'olam aval kodshei kodshim she'enu ne'achalin ki'im l'yom echad layla echad usal kadai techamina shebizman mu'ad kazeh einu bolei kol kach harbe v'yesh takana af l'kli cheresh Bishitifa Kamash Malan teaches opposite. English? He goes, there are some korbanot that are eaten for 2 days. The chatat is only eaten for 1 day. I may have thought that by the type of kodshim which is eaten for 2 days, so if the thing sat in there for 2 days for so long, that's why it absorbed it. So he says specifically the pshat. Why is it taught by the korban chatat, which is only eaten for 1 day, to come to teach you that even if it was absorbed for a more limited amount of time, it still absorbs and doesn't expel, and that's why it's being taught by the Chatat, and he's fully cognizant that what he just now said was pshat. The next words, right, it doesn't have to be that situation, but he's saying that had it been written by the Kudshin that was longer, so then maybe you would have suspected that was the case. So he says this is in order that you shouldn't have that suspicion, therefore it had to be written by a Korban, which where the notar clock is a much shorter clock. And then he writes about Sad HaRemez. So when he writes outside haremez, what is he saying to us? As I said, the English word, I think, is homiletics over here. I mean, you could say remez, describe it differently, but that's what he's doing. He says, no, this comes to teach us something else. Outside haremez, karov l'shmoa. So now you know this was part of his drasha. I mean, you just know that this is what he got up and he said. Outside haremez, karov l'shmoa, shatarata kelim, yeshlam dimyum latarata chote. He says that there is a certain comparison between the fixing of the kelim, of the utensils, and the fixing of the sinner. Now he's explaining why it's written in terms of the korban chatat. He goes, because there's a certain message that we should be getting. L'chotei ha-makriv chatat. Ki kamo sheha-kelim yesh mehem shebol'im harbei. There's some types of utensils that absorb a great deal min ha-isur, of the prohibited object, and they're not going to be able to go just by washing them off. There are some ways that the only way you can fix this is by breaking it. And some don't absorb so much. And it's enough to wash off. Likewise, you have sinners who've absorbed so much of what's not allowed. The kashla lazova hergel, now it becomes difficult for him to get rid of his what has now become his addictions, his norm. The ein lo takana, and there's nothing that he could do to fix it. Ki im b'shvirat libo, the only thing that he has to do is he has to break his heart, as it were. What he's talking about is a major level of transformation in order to basically change the whole personality in order to rid himself of what has now become his habitual sinful ways. Kihu hakli shenitbashel bo hiisur, because he is the utensil where the forbidden thing has been cooked. V'yesh lecha adam she'enu b'leia harbe, and then there are those who don't absorb as much of the sin. V'yesh lo takana b'kol dehu, and they can be fixed in a much more limited way. K'derech she'omru chazal as chazal say, mai takante she'masaper lashon hara, im tamid chacham yasok b'torah. And as the Gemara says, that when it comes to a Talmud Chacham, what he's claiming, and a lot of what he's going to say here will be about the advantages of a Talmud Chacham when it comes to sinning. This will be motivation to learn more. Because what he's really trying to say about this is that by the Talmud Chacham, essentially the personality is one which is an elevated personality, and the sins which are done are incidental to the personality, while you're going to have real bona fide sinners where the personality is a personality of a sinner. So the personality of a sinner you need to break that personality and change. On the other hand, his example of a Talmid Chacham, somebody whose personality is elevated, but he speaks Lashon Hara. Okay, we need to change that. But it's an element that needs to be changed, but it's not an entire personality that needs to be transformed. So he says he should be Ya'asok b'Torah. There's a book, Keter Rosh. It's written by Rav Chaim Volozhin. And a lot of the Musar books deal with what they speak about, the Chetan Arim. What they're talking about is masturbation. And in the Musar books, they talk about how the person's going to die, they've disturbed their soul, and this is the worst thing. A lot of Rav Nachman Mibreslov's whole Tikkun HaKali and so on is all focused on trying to somehow fix this destroyed personality and so on. And Rav Chaim Volozhin there, in passing, quotes from his Rebbe from the Vilna Gaon. He goes, ignore all the Musar books, they're very bad for you. This is long before Volozhin never introduced Musar. He goes, they're all bad for you. He goes, same point, Talmidei Chachamim should learn Torah. He goes, learning Torah is something which can heal any kind of sins which a person has done. So I'm saying what the Kli Yakar is saying over here, the Vilna Gaon used there as a, if you want, a psychological healing, instead of people walking around with a destroyed personality, he is saying, learn more Torah and become more elevated and don't drive yourself crazy. That's really what the Rav Chaim Volozhin quotes from the Vilna Gaon. Over here, he continues, Alkein katva ha-Torah dina kelim etzel ha-chatat. Therefore, specifically, it's written about breaking the kelim by the chatat, lo malacha, shebizman she'in zevach u'mencha, az tarata chotei katarata kelim. Ki kol ama aretz nimshal l'kli cheres. The ama aretz is like the kli cheres, v'ein yotze midei tofav ki'im b'shvirat libo, v'kol tamid chacham, yesh lo din kli nechoshet, yesh lo takana yidei merika v'shtifa mi'beit u'bachutz. It goes, the Talmud Chacham needs to fix himself, clean up, fix your thing, but it doesn't need to be broken. So, as I said, it's really quite interesting, and he goes on with this for a while. I don't believe we need to go on. You have the rest of it, and he spells this out. But I do want to mention something, which Rabbi Soloveitchik once said, and at the time that I said it, I strongly suspected that it was also homiletics or Rabbi Soloveitchik. You had to be, it's very dangerous when people quote him, because you had to know when he said something with a twinkle in his eye or a smile on his face versus when he said something, you know, in complete seriousness. So he spoke about the following Gemara. So let's read it. It's one of the known Gemarot in dealing with with one of the ten martyrs. Source number 6, we're entering in right in the middle. The Gemara starts long before this, and it ends after this. It's a long page dealing with martyrdom. Amru lo yamim utim ad sheniftar Rabbi Yossi ben Kisma. Rabbi Yossi ben Kisma, he was one who advocated obeying the Romans, behaving, not teaching publicly, while others disagreed with him. But Rabbi Yossi ben Kisma passed away. And he received a great deal of honor from the Romans because he was somebody who had basically respected the Roman law. Vispiduhu hesped gadol uvachazaratan, and they returned from the funeral. The Roman dignitaries matzu the Rebbe Chanina ben Tradion shoyah yoshev osik b'torah. So when they come back, what do they find? They find that somebody who had argued with this Rabbi Yossi ben Kisma, somebody who refused to stop teaching, somebody who was still teaching Torah, and they find him, Rabbi Chanina ben Tradion. Shehoy Yosef Osek b'Torah umakil kehilot b'rabim. Very similar description to Rabbi Akiva. He was sitting and teaching, but not just teaching. He was teaching publicly. One more element is added over here. The Sefer Torah munach lo b'cheko. And he's holding the Sefer Torah in his lap, in his hands. Heviu korchu b'Sefer Torah. They took him and they wrapped him in the Sefer Torah. V'kifu b'chavili zmurot. And then they wrapped him also with little twigs, vehitzitu bahena ta'ur, and they lit the twigs aflame. Vivis fugin shel tzemer usharum b'mayim. And then they took tufts of wool, they soaked them in water, v'nichum alibo, and they put them next to his chest, kidei shelo teitzei nishmato mehira, in order that he not die too quickly. So they have this person, they're killing him, they're executing him by burning him alive, but they want to make sure that he will suffer as much as possible, and this will go as slow as possible. Amrlo Bito, this daughter presumably is Bruria, married to Rabbi Meir. Continuation of the Gemara tells us more about Rabbi Meir. Amrlo Bito, Abba, Eroch, Erecha b'kach. She says, Father, how can I see you like this? Amar la, he says, Ilmole ani nisrafti levadi, haya kasha devarli. Had I alone had been set aflame and I alone had been killed, burnt, perhaps it would be difficult. V'achshav shani nisraf v'sefer Torah imi, but now what they are doing, they're burning me together with the Sefer Torah. Mi sheyivakesh elbona shel Torah, hu yivakesh elboni. He who's going to go and take vengeance on the insult to the Torah will take vengeance for my insult as well, for what they're doing to me as well. Amulo Tamidav, his students say to him, Rabbi, ma tara'eh, what do you see? Which itself is a very interesting question. It could be one, what does the future hold? What are we to do? Should we follow you, Rav Yossi ben Kisma? Again, I think we can certainly read between the lines over here. So he says, what do you see? So he gives an incredible answer. And he says, Amar lahem, gvilin nisrafim v'otiyot parachot. He says, the scroll is being burnt, but the letters are going up into heaven. This is reminiscent of when Moshe breaks the Luchot. Also there we're told that the letters go back up into heaven. The question is, does it go in when he breaks it or before he breaks it? The way the Yerushalmi describes it is before he breaks it, when they're sinning the golden calf, the Luchot lose the letters. The letters go back up into heaven. So over here again, he's saying that the letters are going back up into heaven, and they're only burning the physical thing, which means what he's saying is that they can destroy the body, they're not destroying the soul. They can burn the Sefer Torah, but the words are going to stay alive. So essentially, when they're saying, what do you see? He's saying that we will be victorious because they can only kill the body and not the spirit. The spirit is going to remain, the soul is going to remain, and as long as our souls remain, we are going to remain victorious, and we will last. So when he gives this answer, they respond and say, "Afata petach picha v'tikanais b'cha ha'esh." They say to him, "So why don't you too open up your mouth and let the fire go in?" Essentially saying, "So your soul will survive and your body will be killed. Why do we need the suffering to be prolonged?" Which is exactly what they're trying to do to him. So therefore, soul will survive. So the same thing that you just now said regarding the scroll. And he was the one who linked himself with the scroll, right? Had it only been me, then perhaps, but the scroll is being burnt, God would take vengeance. So therefore, they're following his lead and saying, if that's the case, just like the Torah is being burnt, the letters are surviving, let your body be burnt, and the soul will survive. He then gives a very dramatic answer, which will be used in the Middle Ages whenever discussing martyrdom, certainly by the Balei HaTosfot, who knew about martyrdom. Amr Lahem, he says, Mutav she'etlenu misha natna. Let he who gave the soul take it, va'al yechbol hu ba'atzmo, and let a person never harm themselves. Rabbeinu Tam comments and qualifies this, and says, you shouldn't harm yourself if you will remain spiritually intact. But if you're afraid you won't remain spiritually intact, then you can harm yourself. And Rabbeinu Tam, therefore, gave license to all of those who, in the face of the Crusades and the forced baptism, that they were allowed to kill themselves and even their children. Again, Rabbeinu Tam most likely gave this allowance after the fact, because you had martyrs who killed themselves and killed their families rather than being baptized. So Rabbeinu Tam was faced with essentially an impossible situation. Do you then call the great martyrs of the Middle Ages, do you call them sinners? Do you call them notorious sinners? Or do you find some kind of license to have allowed what they have done? So as I said, there's a lot of discussion among historians, halachic historians, halachists, regarding this point. So Rabbeinu Tam qualifies this and tries to fit it back into the story. Of course, as Professor Chaim Soloveitchik pointed out, what's most interesting is that the discussion is regarding agadatot and not regarding halacha. And the fact that the agadatot were used may itself be very telling that we're not necessarily dealing with halachic categories or halachic situations. Anyway, nonetheless, he said, let he who gave life take life, and a person should not harm themselves. If that's the case, he cannot possibly do anything in order to speed up his death. Amalo klastinure. And now we have an unexpected voice come out, somebody who's been observing all of this, somebody who's been involved in all of this, and somebody who, the truth is, initiated all of this, and that is the executioner. The executioner then apparently goes through an unbelievable transformation. When I say unbelievable, this is the stuff of literature, not the stuff of history. I'm not saying this didn't happen, quite the opposite. I'm saying this does happen, but this is not what we expected. Here's a person, if we look at the whole trajectory of his life, and we know nothing about him other than this little conversation, but if we look at the trajectory of his life, here's a person who probably grows up as a soldier and becomes a very mean soldier, a very accomplished soldier, a very good killer, and he becomes a chief executioner and somebody who's been killing rabbis, and he's watching this, and he's killed people before, and as he's watching this scene take place of these Jews discussing death and discussing life and discussing souls and discussing future and how they're going to survive, he suddenly breaks down. He has a total transformation, and he says the most unexpected sentence, Rabbi, Im ani marbe alecha bishalhevet, if I increase the flames, v'notel sfugin shel tzemer me'al libcha, and I take away the wool which has been soaked in water on your chest, atami v'in l'olam haba, will you bring me to the world to come? Now, before I continue, just want to point out, these two elements are not the same. Increasing the flames presents one problem. Removing the wool presents a different problem. There's a source which is in the Sefer Chassidim, which makes its way into the Shulchan Aruch, cited by the Ramah, that this is the case of the woodchopper. If there's a person chopping wood, and unfortunately inside a hut there's somebody who's in his last moments of life, he takes his very last breath, and then there's silence, and then right outside the woodchopper gives a clop. And the guy opens up his eyes and starts to breathe again. So this is the middle age, you know, what do they call it when they take the two... what? Not sim, no. No, the fibrillator, and they give the right, okay, clear, and then they put the thing on the heart, and they try to shock him back in. But this is, as I said, a primitive description of the same exact thing. The person has taken their last breath. They hear this noise, and they jump up. So now the Sefer Chassidim then presents, not as a question, he just tells us what's correct, but I'll present it as a question. So should we tell the person who's chopping wood, keep on chopping, chop louder, and keep this person in this world? Or do we say this, can you stop chopping, please? The guy's trying to die. Let the guy rest in peace. So what is the correct thing to do? So the way the Ramah writes this in the Shulchan Aruch, again, quoting the Sefer Chassidim says, one should not do something to prevent somebody from dying. Let the person die in peace. The way the Ramah quotes in the Darkei Moshe, he says it's a mitzvah to help somebody die in peace. And if there's something which is preventing death, it should be removed. Which means, and this is going to be a real, real subtlety, if you can do something which prolongs life, you prolong life. If you could do something which prevents death, you have to remove it. So now, how do I decide what's preventing death and what's preserving life? So that means a much larger contextual understanding of it. And rest assured, Poskim in our generation, the previous generation, had to deal with things like a respirator. Yeah, with the respirator, is this considered to be euthanasia? Is it not euthanasia? Is something permitted or is it not permitted? Under what circumstances is it going to be analogous to this? And I'm saying this is a large discussion which we're not going to have right now, but I'm just pointing out that these two things, removing the wool is not giving life. The wool is not giving life. The wool is there for one reason, and that is to slow down the process of death, but it's not there to give life. It's not there to save in any way. So therefore, when he says, can I remove the wool, I think that's much easier to allow. The Shulchan Aruch even brings, what if a person is lying on a pillow which has feathers in it, and one of the feathers is sticking out and sticking in the guy's head, and it's keeping him alive? He says you can take the pillow away and take the feather away so the person won't be agitated and they can rest in peace. So I'm just saying, it's not a question of something outside, inside, or whatever. So he even applies it to such a case. Now, full stop. But how does he allow him to increase the flames? So my suspicion on this is, and then we'll move right back to the story and get to the point I wanted to get to, my suspicion is that this executioner is already guilty of murder. He's not going to survive. The only question is how quickly or how slowly. So if you're guilty of murder once, could you be guilty of the same murder a second time? So there's a case in Baba Kama of somebody drops something out of the window, and then as it's falling to the ground, you hit it. So are you guilty for breaking something which was already considered to be halachically broken because it's already falling down, this may very well be analogous to it. This person's already, I won't say he's dead, but he's dying. And for somebody else to speed up death, they would be guilty of speeding up death. But over here, when this is the executioner, one gets the suspicion that maybe it's okay. Either way, the problem would be, a moment ago when his students say, open your mouth, take in the flames, take in the smoke, do something to cause the death to come quicker, he goes, no, let he who gave life take life. Now the executioner says, if I remove the wool and I increase the flames, will I have a share in the world to come? So as I said, this transformation that just now took place in the executioner is remarkable. So Rabbi Chanina ben Tradion responds and says, yes. Omer le hein, yes. Ishtab Ali, he says, swear to me. Ishtabalo, he swore to him. Miyad hirbe alav bishalhevet, he increased the flames. V'natal sfugin shel tzemer me'al libo, and he took away the wool from his chest. V'yatzta nishpato mehira, and then he died rapidly. Av hukafatz v'nafal atocha ur. At that moment, the executioner jumped into the fire as well. Yotzta batkol va'amra, and a voice comes out and says, Rabbi Chanina ben Tradion u klastenuro. Rabbi Chanina ben Tradion and his executioner, mizumanim l'chayelum abba, are both invited to the world to come. Bacha Rebbe va'amar, and Yehuda Nasi heard the story, he cried and he said, Yesh kona olamo b'sha achat. There are some people who achieve this share in the world to come in but one moment. V'yesh kona olamo b'kama shanim. There are others who toil for many, many years before they're able to have a share in the world to come. So Rabbi Soloveitchik's question was, this person was an executioner. This person wasn't Jewish. This person was a terrible human being. How in the world does this person have a share in the world to come? And Rabbi Soloveitchik said, and I'll say it again, he said it with a smile, or at least a twinkle in his eye. He said, some people to convert, they need to go into mikveh. Some people to convert, they need to jump into the flames. They need to go into fire. Some people need mikveh, some people need libun gomor, right? Complete burning of the personality. Now, if you think about it, this is very, very close to what the Kli Yakar were saying. The Kli Yakar were saying that some personalities just need this complete transformation, and which is really what happens over here. So again, I suspect this too is homiletics. But just because it's homiletics, one second, but there is such a thing as good homiletic. Yeah, but this is not just a sorry. This is much more than a sorry. This is much more than a sorry. Here, again, as I said, Rabbi Soloveitchik said this, and I do want to stress, I believe it's homiletics. He goes, where was the mikveh that he went through? So if I would say baptism of fire, I'll get into trouble. So I won't say that. But he's again using terminology of kashering. So this is Liban Gomor. You want to say it's Hagala? It's better than Hagala. This is Liban Gomor, which this person needs in order to transform itself. But you're right. The transformation we already see a moment before when he's changing teams. He's changing sides. He's leaving the Romans who are all powerful and he's joining the victims over here and he wants to become one of the martyrs himself. So that's really just a remarkable teaching. But this really is an example of what I think the Kli Yakar was referring to. It could be she didn't. And it could be that there was a process over there. There's a process of conversion that Ruth went through. And it doesn't mean that it all happened in one day. It could be that it happens over a period of time. There's a lot to talk about this. Aval lo achshav. You can say, Eimatai, aval lo achshav. The situation of kashering kelim, though, is written not just in our verse in Parshat Tzav regarding kodshim. It also finds itself in another place in that source number 7. And this is the war against Midian. Vayomer Elazar kohen anshei hatzava ba'im lemelchama zot kulchat haTorah sheziva Hashem et Moshe ach et hazahav ve'et hakesef et hakasef et hanechoshet et habarzel et habdil ve'et haoferet kol devar asher yavo be'esh taviu be'esh v'taher ach mimei nida yitchata v'kol asher lo yavo be'esh taviu b'mayim u'kivastem begdeichem yom shvi'i tahartem v'achar tavo el hamachaneh. So over here it also deals with the question of what kind of things can be cleaned or purified and how they can be purified. Rashi in 8 tells us, Kol devar asher yavo ba'esh, levashel bo kulam, taviru ba'esh, kederech tashmisho hagalato, ma shetashmisho al yedei chamin, yagilenu b'chamin, u ma shetashmisho al yedei tzli, kagon hashiput va'askala, yilbenelenu ba'or. So he says that here's the general principle, the way that something is absorbed, that's the way that it's expelled. And it tells us about the various kashering that takes place. There is going to be some intrigue here. Let's see.
I guess we could do a little of the intrigue. In the next line, Rashi quotes the verse, Ach bimei nida yitchata. Yitchata means to purify. In modern Hebrew also, chitoy is to make something sterilize. To sterilize something is chitoy in modern Hebrew. Af meida yitchata, lefi pshuto chitoy ze latahar mitum otmeit. He said the pshat over here is that you need to clean off these kelim from having been in contact with the dead. Amar lehem tzrichim hakelim gi'ul l'taharam min ha'isur. But they also need hagalah in order to take away the non-kosher aspects over here. V'chitoy l'taharam min ha'tum'ah. And in order to sterilize them, as it were, to purify them from the tum'ah, from the impurity. V'rabotenu dor shumikan sha'af l'hachshiram min isur hit'in tfilah l'kli matechet. And the rabbis learned from this that not only do they need to go through the process of perhaps the same fire, kashrin, they also need to go to the mikvah. And why? Because the phrase in the Torah was, once again, in Pasuk Kaf Gimel, was, kol devar sheyavo be'esh tavir be'esh v'taher, ach b'mei nida yitchata. So what does b'mei nida mean? So he writes, so Rashi writes that Chazal understood this, that needed tefillah, u'mei nida haktuvim kan darshu mayim haru'uyim l'tfo behem nida. It's the same kind of water, a mikvah, that a nidah would go to. Ukamahim arbeim sa'ah. That means that all of these things need to go through the mikvah. Now, why would they need to go through the mikvah? So, very quickly, and we're going to come back to where we are now in a moment, but just look at the last source, 17. It's the Yerushalmi in Avodah Zarah, which has a whole discussion regarding kashering, but we're 60% down in the source, where it's bolded. Atat tzarech lahatpil. Why do you need to put something in the mikvah, l'fisha yotsu mituma tanachri v'nichnasu l'ktushat Yisrael. Basically, it's conversion. It's a case of conversion. That just like a person can be converted by going to the mikvah, the kelim need to be converted, and that's why the kelim need to go to the mikvah. There is going to be some intrigue among the Rishonim over here, including Rashi, the Ibn Ezra, and the Rashbam, and the Ramban, whether we're dealing with a Torah law or a rabbinic law. Rashi, who's saying this is a pshat, seems to be saying it over as a Torah law. The Rashbam says, what does it mean, ach b'mei nida, shel para aduma, l'tara mitumat nefesh? He's saying, pshat? You need to sprinkle it with, that's what mei nida means in this case, you need to sprinkle it with the ashes, the water from the ashes of the paraduma, because it had come in contact with the dead. In source number 3, the Ibn Ezra writes also, ach b'mei nida yitchata, hayanir lanu kuhu mei afar hapara. He goes, what is this? This is the sprinkling from the paraduma. Again, the type of tumah we're dealing with is tumat meit. Kamo mei nida lo zarekala, v'chazal amru kitamo b'shi'ur hamayim shenitrochetz b'hema isha nida. And Chazal understood, source number 10, Chazal understood that this is the same kind of water of a woman who's a nidi would go into, v'da'atam rechava mida'atenu. So what does that mean, v'da'atam rechava mida'atenu? He's saying it nicely, that he thinks they have overextended themselves. And that's not really what it means. Da'atam rechava mida'atenu. The Ramban, who has a very similar discussion, in source 12, two-thirds of the way down, V'lashon Sifri, we'll start there, the beginning of the line, K'gon ha-sakinim b'nei k'vayot ha-goyim, V'kol ha-sher lo yavo ba'esh, K'gon ha-kosot, T'avri b'mayim b'nei ha-giyul ha-goyim, V'lo hu-tzrach ha-ketuv l'chzor l'skir ha-tfila, Shekvar hiskir ota, Af minida yitchata, V'achri p'lilat yisur, Kulam shavim b'din ha-tfila, V'libi me'harher od, and my heart tells me, it's a very interesting phrase. V'libi maharher od lomer shatfila hazu midivrayim v'hamikra smachta asu alto. He's saying it's not pshat. He goes, it's not a Torah law. He goes, bringing these kelim into the mikvah is not. Yes, there is this conversion taking place. You're taking these kelim, and you. Let's just go back a second because I want to make sure we all know where we are and why we're here. In the beginning, we spoke about kelim that absorb something. So what was in our parsha, what do they absorb? They absorb kudshim. They absorb the taste of something which is holy, and there's a time limit on that, and afterwards you're going to get the prohibition of notar. And we're told that different kalim, be it metal, wood, we didn't talk about wood, but metal, wood, cheres, will absorb in a different way. Most of them will expel as well. The problem with cheres is that it absorbs and doesn't expel. Problem for Ashkenazim, parenthetically, is that the Rav Yah taught, and we rule like the Rav Yah, he taught that glass is made out of cheres, it's made out of the same kinds of materials, and therefore glass has a status as well of cheres. And certainly in terms of Pesach, we are generally machmir for this Rav Yah. So coming back to this point, we found something interesting, that it's not just the law by Kudshim that we're concerned about the residual taste of what's holy that can't be eaten after the time, but we find that in terms of the war against Midian, we're told that things that need to be prepared as well. And there was two different levels of the preparation. One was removing from, actually there were three issues involved. One was tumat mate. Two is that it was used to cook non-kosher food. Three, it was owned by somebody non-Jewish, and therefore it needs to go into the mikveh to become converted. Rashi tells us that that third level seems to be a Torah law, and the other commentaries here, again, be it the Rashbam, be it the Ibn Ezra, be it the Ramban, all sense that this is a rabbinic law, which it's perhaps more symbolic, but it's a rabbinic law. But I still have other problems. What are my other problems? One is the tumat mate, and that's why it needs the sprinkling. But the other issue, which is why we're here, is that these things get absorbed. A kli cheres can't be redeemed. A kli cheres absorbs, and you can't get the taste out, so that non-kosher taste is always going to be there inside, and that is our problem. Then the Ramban points out something which I think is really interesting. So let's take a look. Let's go one more time. He says, "V'libi marher od lomer shatfila hazumi divrayim v'mikras machna asuoto v'chein unkulus mitargemoto b'chitoy hazaa shel afar para." So unkulus also understands that this mei nida really means sprinkling the water of the ashes of the paradum. V'itzricho oto chachamim b'kliya matachot bilvad v'meshiyesh bem kelim. And all this needs to be learnt inside. V'sir otam in depth. V'sir otam ata v'hagalat kli Midian mi'isurei hagoyim. And regarding the kalim of Midian, why Midian? That's the war we're talking about now. This was the battle against Midian. V'lo amar lahem ze mitchila b'kli sichon v'od shalachu gam shlalam. Now, this is parallel to what the Kli Yakar pointed out. Remember, Rashi right away said, oh, this law applies to all Kadshim. So then the Kli Yakar says, yeah, if it's all Kadshim, why is it being taught specifically by Chatat? Over here, the Ramban is making an observation. This is not our first war. This is not the first time we've had battle. It's not the first time we've taken spoils of war. Why is this law being taught over here by the battle against Midian, and it wasn't taught by those previous battles? And that's a very intriguing question. What's more intriguing is his answer. Kamosha Amar Raka Behema Bozuzu Lanu Vishalal Arim Asher Lakadnu. Vahatam, and the reason the Ramban says is Ki Sichon Vaog Malche Emorihem Vaartsam Minachalat Yisraelhi. V'hutar lahem kol shalalam afilo isirim tichtiv ubatim meleim kol tuv asher lo mileta. So let's pause there for a second, because we need to understand this. Actually, let's not pause. Let's read the next line. V'amru rabotenu, and the rabbis taught, kidle dechazire ashtor lahu. They were even allowed to eat certain parts of pork in this particular episode. So let's stop right there for a moment, because he just now quoted a pasuk, and let's take a look at the pasuk that he quoted. Those of you who want to eat pork, hold on to your seats. Source number 13. Vayaki v'yacha Hashem alokecha el ha'aretz asher nishba levotech la'avim yitzhak liyakov latet lach. When God is going to bring you to the land which he has promised to the patriarchs, arim gdolot v'tavot asher lo banita, you're going to find cities which you didn't build. Ubatim mleim kol tuv. And now they're given a promise, and you can take over these houses which will be full of all kinds of things. How, you know, you didn't fill the fridge, you didn't fill the freezer, you didn't fill the houses with stuff. Ubarot chatzovim mashalo chatzavta, kramim v'zeitim mashalo natata, v'achalta v'savata. they're going to have a kerem, how do you say this in English?
Vineyards,
they're going to have wells which have already been dug, but the homes will be full of things. So excuse me a second. If the homes are full of things, so what do you think? You think God is going to give divine inspiration to all of the non-Jews who were living there before, the seven nations? Please make sure to only buy Badatz products before the Jews come so that they can enjoy only glatt kosher food. But, excuse me?
Absolutely.
So that's nice. But over here you have a pasuk. Now you can say that this is just a turn of phrase and this doesn't really mean what it says over here, although we get uncomfortable when someone tells you it's not what it means. But it says that, you know, you're going to walk in. Now, again, I could say pshat is you're going to walk into built cities. You're going to walk into places that already have planted vineyards. You're going to walk into places that already have the wells which are dug. But it didn't only say that. What else did it say? But it said another thing. Ubatim le'im kol tuv. And houses which are full of all kinds of wonderful things. V'chalta v'savata. And enjoy, have a good time. The Gemara in source number 14, which we're jumping in the middle of a discussion, it wants to know at which point they were no longer allowed to eat what's called basar nechira, and at which point they needed to eat properly slaughtered food. One of the important things here is that laws of kosher evolve from various stages earlier till you would have thought at Matan Torah it all changes, but it's saying that's not exactly the case. It starts, Bar Rabbi Yirmiyah, he asked, and over here you see I have a little comment. He asked Rabbi Akiva, in the Midbar, they were allowed to eat basar nechira, which means that it wasn't really properly what we would consider to be glatt kosher meat today. A very basar nechira, shechnistu Yisrael imam la'aretz mahu. So when the Jews carried in things that had previously been allowed to eat, and now they entered the land of Israel, can they still eat them? So the Gemara asked, Eman, when are we talking about? Elim, b'shiva, shekivshu, are we talking about the seven nations that they captured? Hashtadavar, tami, ishtori, lahu. He goes, of course, they're allowed to eat things that are worse than that. Dichtiv, ubatim, leim, koltuv. Because it says, the verse that we just now saw, homes that are full of all kinds of wonderful things. V'amr v'yumi, v'abba, amr rav, kitle, dichazire. Which over here, we have translated, look at Rashi, Chazirim Yeveshim Shekorim, I don't know, Bikinish, I don't know, they stuck it. Bacon. Ah, it's bacon. Bacon's. Bacon. So Rashi here says that they had bacon. They had bacon when they came into these homes. I don't know what your aliyah package was, if Nefesh B'Nefesh still takes care of this for you. Ubatim Laim Kotuv. Because the verse ends up, you should eat and you should enjoy it. So let's now go to the Ramban on that part, the Ramban on that section. Vinei hutru lahem kol ha'isurim zulati iser avodah zarah. When the Jews entered into the land of Israel, all prohibited things were allowed, with one exception. What exception was that? Avodah zarah. Because that they had an obligation to destroy. La beit avodah zarah u'mishamsha. V'shar kol ha'nimtza ba'aretz mutar, and anything else they found was allowed. V'ya ha'heter hazeh ad she'achlu shlal oyveihem, until they finished everything which they captured. So, no, you cannot go and capture a home today and go and eat the pork chops within, you know, in the freezer. But this is saying is that when they captured the land of Israel from the seven nations. So let me just remind you how we got here. The Ramban said specifically in the Battle of Midian, it gives the whole consideration, you need to kasher and make sure even the taste of the non-kosher food has been removed, but the battles against nations that were among the seven nations as part of the MRE, those nations' different rules apply, and the Ramban continues and he says over here, that was allowed, V'yesh omrim b'sheva shekavshu, we just now saw, and most understand this. The Ramban tells us that it's only the seven nations. V'harav, who's the Rav? Katav b'echot melachim u'melchumateihem. The Rav is the Rambam. The Rambam in the Laws of Wars, Kings and Wars, wrote, chalutzei tzava, those people who are in part of army units, sheyikansu b'gvul ha'akum, who go off into the border, cross the borders into the neighboring lands of the idolaters, v'kivshum v'yishbu bahem, they capture them and they take spoils. Mutar lahem lechol nevelot utrefot, that at war you're allowed to eat nevela, trefa, ubasar chazir, ukeyotsebo, im yirav. The Rambam qualified it and said that if you're hungry, if we've had problems, you know, again, I don't know how much you are aware or have thought about this, one of the largest, if not the largest problem, we won't qualify it, the largest problem that any army ever has is the food, is supplies, is how you get supplies from place to place, how do you feed your soldiers. So over here he's saying that you crossed into enemy land and there's no osher ad, right? There's no supermarkets, there's no kosher food over there. So what do you do? So the Rambam says, so if you're hungry, what do? You eat nevela, you trefi, you eat chazir. All this is allowed. He actually continues. If you don't find anything else, so then you eat these things. And you also are even allowed to drink the non-kosher wine, which is quite interesting because Yayin Nesech should be quite problematic. In terms of the Ramban says anything except for Avodah Zarah. So over here he says you can drink wine of Avodah Zarah. And the Rambam is quoting our verse. And he says, because we learned, you can even eat, what's orpe chazirim? I don't know, pork bellies, we're back to the bacon, I don't know. So the Ramban then writes about this Rambam, Be'en Zenachon. He disagrees. Shelo bishvil pikoach nefesh, or ra'avon bilvad utar b'shat milchama, it's not just pikoach nefesh, or that you're hungry, ela achash ha'kavshar rima gdolot v'atavot v'yashvu ehem, hitir lehem shalal oyvehem. It wasn't just because you're hungry. It's that there was a special dispensation when we captured the land of Israel that allowed us to eat all the things that we found in those homes. That's what that pasuk was. V'lo b'kol chalutzei tzavan. And he goes, it's not like the Rambam said. The Rambam makes it sound like it's today as well. You go off into Lebanon. I actually once got a phone call from an officer in Lebanon and says, we just walked into a supermarket, which was Hezbollah-owned supermarket, and we want to take the water. We need water, and the soldiers are arguing whether we should leave money or not. I mean, this never made it to the United Nations about the Israeli army. They're questioning whether taking water, which is kosher, whether we've captured this and therefore it's ours, or whether we need to leave money for it because it's stealing. So the soldiers were going back and forth, and debating this. And they call, yeah. So I'm saying, I got a call from love. I got a call from the middle of the war. My answer is less important than this. You're going to war now. Seriously, when we capture things, they belong to the collective. They don't belong to individuals. So they're right. I mean, you walk into the museum. Oh, that's a nice piece. I'm taking that home. I captured it in war. No, it belongs to the collective. It doesn't belong to the individual. So it's very important over here that individual soldiers don't get the sense that I can take what I want because of this, because they are representing an army and representing a country. So therefore, it's only if it can be done on a larger level where the commanding officer is a sense of representing the army, saying that, okay, we have captured this and now we have orders that we are allowed to give this out. But it can't be on an ad hoc basis, because that leads to corruption and that leads to theft. An individual doesn't have the right. The collective has the right. So that's basically the approach that you should understand if this comes up. Okay? So to continue on this point, the Ramban argues and says, no, there was a special dispensation. We entered the land of Israel. We were told that we can enjoy all kinds of things. Let's again. It's not talking about any time we go to war. Where did he get that from? That was the pasuk. So the Ramban is being very specific in terms of the context of the pasuk. It's when you enter the land that this applies, which, again, I think is the Pshat in the Gemara. And the Rambam took this as general ethics of war, which is really quite interesting. And he expands it even to Yayin Nesech. V'chein Yayin Nesech sh'eschir einu amet. He goes, the Rambam said you can drink the wine. He goes, what are you talking about? She'bekul yisuri vodazara hu atzmo misham sh'er v'takarot shela hakol asur. He goes, no, this was, everything was, non-kosher was allowed with one exception, and that was idolatry, and that was never allowed. So let's just go back and try to wrap this up. This idea, which really is a Pesach idea, it's all year in terms of kashrut, in terms of problems that come up. I cooked my meat in the milk thing, and I cooked the milk in the meat, things got combined, I mixed things up, or so on. I mean, these are basic laws of kashrut that most of us have, I assume. We have, if we eat both milk and meat separately, then we have milk pots and meat pots, and some of us are very wise and have power of pots as well, and the same thing is true with knives and all kinds of things. And all of that is, you know, the background of this. In Pesach, things get a little bit more interesting because we have an extra issue. If when you go away for all of Pesach, you've solved everything. When you have, as is often the case in this generation, you have different Pesach utensils, then you've solved everything. But, I mean, there was a time that we kashered much more, and there's still a lot of kashering. There's still a lot of kashering going on before Pesach. I'm just saying it's much less than it once was. So all of this is in the background over here. But what we really saw over here is that it's two extremes. On the one hand, this week's parasha spoke about the taste which is absorbed in the klicheres or in the metal utensils, where the concern is not something not kosher per se, but it's holy, it's kadosh, and therefore it's notar, and we can't use it for general use, and we have to be concerned, and therefore we're told about the klicheres that must be broken. On the other hand, we find that it was also the topic in terms of the war against Midian. And over there, the concerns were the non-kosher food, tumat mate. The concerns were perhaps the quote-unquote conversion of the kli, conversion of the utensil, which, as we saw, most other than Rashi understood to be more of a rabbinic law or an asmachta rather than being a Torah law. But the Ramban made an interesting observation that this is written in the battle against Midian, but when the Jews entered into the land of Israel, then there were different rules one time only, other than the Rambam. And the Rambam wrote more about war than most other people did, so how much that Rambam has impact, I don't know. But the Rambam says you go to war and you don't have what to eat, not just because of Pekuach Nefesh. He's saying you're hungry. Again, he didn't say you're dying. You're hungry. It seems to be that certain rules change, and I would assume that soldiers would behave in this particular way, this ethic that the Rambam gives. But again, what is interesting, it's not pekuach nefesh, but I do want to qualify that a little bit. For a soldier to be hungry is actually pekuach nefesh. For sometimes soldiers will ask me, or police have asked me, a fast day is coming, should I wear my, do I have to, let's say Yom Kippur, should I wear my boots or should I wear sneakers? So are you on duty? What does your officer say? Will you be a better soldier if you're wearing your boots? Then wear your boots, because that's your job right now. That's what you're doing. There is this potential pekuach nefesh along the way. Should I fast if you're on duty? Absolutely not. You should. You need to do what you're doing. You need to do it properly, which means that being a good soldier includes not being fatigued and not being hungry and so on. So the Rambam over here is actually really interesting, because he didn't say it's pekuach nefesh. He goes, if you're hungry, now you can eat these things, assuming there's nothing else available. So the Rambam really made a really interesting application of these laws, even though the Rambam knew as well as the Ramban is, and as well as we know, that this idea that you can go eat the pig is actually the context of it is written in terms of when you enter into the land of Israel. But what I did want to end is where we paused in the middle, that what I think is the beautiful homiletics of the Kli Yakar, where what he's telling us is that as we're involved before Pesach and kashering things and fixing things, and we're concerned with the pots and the pans and the oven and the stove and whatever else we're in, he's saying is also think about the spiritual dynamic of how things impact us and how sins sometimes affect us and how sometimes we need to go through transformations, or sometimes we need to clean on the inside, clean on the outside. And rather than leaving these laws as just mechanical, technical laws in terms of taste being absorbed, I think it was very interesting and very important to tell us that there's also a spiritual dynamic over here which we can discern from these laws and apply to our spiritual selves as well. Anyway, everyone should have a Chag Kasher v'Sameach.